You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Lucinda Larnock. This is the WFHB local news for Thursday, April 22nd, 2021.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Max Campbell reports on last week's mass shooting in Indianapolis. He speaks with Indiana University professor and former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Bill Helmke, and president of the Sikh Student Association, Ravleen Ahuja. More in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, WFHB's Spring Fun Drive kicks off today. WFHB's Cade Young and Jake Jacobson offer a testimonial in light of our fun drive, which is taking place from Earth Day to May Day. More following today's feature. But first, your local headlines.
The Bloomington City Council continued discussion on amendments to the Unified Development Ordinance at their April 21st meeting. Zoning planner Ryan Roebling presented an ordinance that reduces the floor plate size and density of student housing. He said building plans can exceed these limitations if they meet affordable housing incentives.
In multifamily and mixed-use districts, it's changing student housing separation requirements so that buildings on one lot also need to be meet the separation requirement. Projects using the affordable housing incentive are exempt from this requirement. In multifamily and mixed-use districts, reducing building floor plate maximums by half. Projects using the affordable housing incentives may have double the floor plate maximum. In the mixed-use student housing district, setting a building floor plate maximum whereas it did not exist before. Projects using affordable housing incentives will have no maximum in that district. These changes are made to adjust the size limitations to be more appropriate. In the residential high density district, reducing maximum building height by one story. Projects that need additional height may meet affordable housing incentives and can be taller. This adjustment is made so that the maximum height is more appropriate for by right projects.
Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith proposed an amendment to the ordinance. She suggested student housing may also exceed limitations if the plans meet sustainable development incentives. Director of Planning and Transportation Scott Robinson supported this amendment. He said the ordinance was meant to include these incentives.
That was not our intent when drafting this change to the UDO. We did want to include both the affordable housing incentive as well as the sustainability incentive.
Council members unanimously voted to adopt the amendment. Roebling said the ordinance would remove a requirement that builders send notice to landowners within 300 feet of construction. Councilmember Dave Rollo proposed an amendment that reinstated the requirement. He questioned attorney Mike Rauker as to why the city does not support this practice now, even though they supported it before.
We've had this policy and the administration supported it when we adopted it. Why did you support it then?
You know, I can't address that with anything better than to say we are constantly trying to learn from policies that we enact and improve, and we don't see any purpose to this notice, and we have experienced the fact that it does create confusion and frustration among those recipients of the notice who only discover that they don't really have any way to oppose an ADU that's by right.
Resident Kathy Crabtree agreed that the notice is confusing. Piedmont Smith suggested the council should not legislate courtesy. The amendment failed 8-1. Council members unanimously voted to approve the ordinance as amended.
The Monroe County Commissioners moved to approve additional funds for intersection improvements. At the April 21st meeting, Highway Director Lisa Ridge talked about the project, which will make improvements to the intersection at Curry Pike, Smith Pike, and Woodyard Road. She said the Indiana Department of Transportation stepped up to help fund the project.
I want to thank NDOT because actually they reached out to me on this one. And, you know, we went from having I think it was about $580,000 from MPO money originally to this project, and we're up to $2.4 million. And that is all due to NDOT stepping up and helping Monroe County with this project.
Commissioner Penny Githens identified the intersection needs a lot of work. Commissioner Julie Thomas commented that this will help build on previous improvements made to the intersection. Commissioners unanimously approved the funding.
The Monroe County Redevelopment Commission discussed its partnership with the Richland Bean Blossom Community School Corporation. County Attorney Jeff Cockerell presented changes to the commission's agreement with RBBCSC. He explained the changes clarify the difference between STEAM education and the Ready Schools program.
The purpose of these changes was, one, to tie and kind of clarify a little bit what's the difference between the STEM program, which we have funded, versus the Ready School initiative, which is what the request is for. How they came up with the Ready School initiatives, and particularly making sure that we include in here that they got feedback from local employers, and that they have seen other school boards, schools, utilize these programs to great success. And then I think, and then finally, that the Ready School program is an evolution of the STEM program. And so we would expect over the course of time that it would continue to evolve, but that the core principles and what the RDC doing is kind of funding that change so that when after the change has occurred, it will be still part of their curriculum.
Richland Bean Blossom Superintendent Jerry Sanders clarified that the STEAM curriculum is not being replaced. Ready Schools Project Coordinator Jamie Miller said the state content is being changed to align with local employers. Commissioners voted unanimously to approve the agreement.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, we turn to WFHB correspondent Max Campbell for an interview with Indiana University professor and former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Bill Helmke, an expert on gun policy. Campbell also speaks with the president of the Sikh Student Association, Ravleen Ahuja. We turn to correspondent Max Campbell for more.
Last Thursday, a lone gunman killed 8 people and injured several others in a mass shooting at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis. Over the past year, leading up to this tragedy, multiple concerns were raised regarding the shooter's mental health. These concerns were so significant that at one point in March of 2020, the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department seized a shotgun from the shooter's possession. Despite this, nearly a year later, a loophole in Indiana's Jake Laird law, also known as the Red Flag Law, allowed the guns used in the FedEx shooting to come into the shooter's possession. To further understand the Jake Laird Law and how this loophole was exploited, WFHB met virtually with Indiana University professor and former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Bill Helmke. Bill has used his expertise in gun legislation and public policy in positions as the former president and CEO of the Brady Center and the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Helmke elaborated on how exactly the Jake Laird Law works in the context of the FedEx tragedy.
In Indiana, actually, it was one of the leaders in the country in terms of trying to take weapons away from dangerous people. Back in 2004, there was an incident where an individual killed a family member, killed a police officer, shot and wounded 4 other police officers, and then was killed by the police. After the shootout, it was determined that the weapons he'd used to kill the other police officer had actually been seized by the police earlier and had been returned to him. And when our legislators and law enforcement folks realized that there was no law on the books that would have allowed the police to keep those weapons, they passed this Jake Laird Law. Basically, it was a copy of what Connecticut had done 6 years earlier. And it's really a gun removal statute more than just a red flag law. It gives Indiana law enforcement the power to ask a judge to take away someone's weapon. Actually, they can take it away without a warrant and then get approval from the court, or they can get the approval from the court first. But if an individual who has been identified as dangerous has a weapon, this gives the police the power to take that weapon away. Then there's supposed to be a hearing 14 days later to determine whether that's permanent or not. So that's a good law to have on the books, but it doesn't go far enough. A number of other states have taken steps since 2005 when Indiana passed this to come up with stronger laws. One of the crucial things is that other states focus on the individual, not on the gun. For some reason, Indiana just decided to focus on the gun. This only applies to individuals that have guns who have been identified as dangerous. So once the gun had been seized by the police a year ago from the FedEx shooter, once the gun had been seized by the police, he basically said, hey, I don't want the gun back anyway. It's not even clear whether the prosecutor is going to hold a hearing since he was no longer a gun owner. But anyways, the prosecutor determined that the main thing, the main focus of the law is to get the gun away from the dangerous person. They had done that. Because of that, the prosecutor, the police, everyone considered the case closed. The catch is that there had never been a court hearing. And because there was no court hearing, the FedEx shooter was never found to be officially a danger to himself or others. And therefore, there was never that record placed into the background check system that gun dealers are supposed to check when they sell a gun. So the loophole here is that even though the family member thought he was dangerous, the police thought he was dangerous, the FBI thought he was dangerous, the prosecutor thought he was dangerous, because there had not been a court finding, he was allowed to buy other weapons. One of the things that I think Indiana should do is to say, let's get that fine. You know, once the police and the family have gotten together and figured out that somebody's dangerous, put an immediately hold on that person's ability to get weapons. Make it clear that the police can take any weapons the person has, and make it clear that that person cannot buy any more weapons. If that had been done, then this incident might not have developed the way it did.
However, regardless of this law and the action taken to previously seize his guns, the shooter was still able to obtain these firearms legally. Haumke speculated the degree to which the shooting could have been prevented.
It's always difficult to say that something could have been prevented, but I think in this situation, something more could have been done to make it harder for this to have happened. Here's an individual whose mother identified him as dangerous over a year ago. And because she told the police about that, they came in and took a shotgun away from him over a year ago. The FBI got involved over a year ago. The Marion County prosecutor got involved over a year ago. Under Indiana's law, his shotgun was taken, and apparently he didn't ask for it back. But because Indiana's law only focuses on removing that gun, until there's a court order that says this person's dangerous, he had the right to go out and buy other guns. And so last summer, on two separate occasions, he bought dangerous weapons, and then he used them last week. If we had had a law on the books that would have said that a dangerous person that is identified as dangerous, that the police feel is dangerous, that the family feel is dangerous, that that person should be put on the prohibited purchaser list, and then if the person contests that they have a chance to get off the list, that procedure might have kept him from getting a gun. But because Indiana basically assumes that anybody should be allowed to buy any gun pretty much anytime and take it anywhere, unless there's been a clear finding that they're dangerous by a court, we end up with these tragedies.
On Monday, WFHB talked to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton, who expressed the difficulty to create progress in gun legislation at his level of authority. Speaking from his own experience as mayor of Fort Wayne, Haumke said he sympathizes with mayors who do not have the ability to regulate gun policies in their cities.
I'm very sympathetic to Mayor Hamilton. I was mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, for 12 years. And one of the things that happened when I was mayor is the Indiana legislature decided to tell cities and towns that they couldn't do anything about gun violence in their communities, couldn't pass any local ordinances. I think in Fort Wayne, we'd had an ordinance at the time saying that you shouldn't be able to discharge your gun in the city parks. And the state legislators, in their wisdom, decided that they knew more about what's going on in local communities, and they preempted all cities in towns in the state from doing anything on their own against gun violence. The Bloomington, I know, faced this a couple years ago when I think during a 4th of July parade, somebody had loaded AR-15s in their float and waving them around at the parade goers. Bloomington had no power to stop that. A year or so ago, when there were protesters at the farmers market in Bloomington bringing guns, the city couldn't do anything about that. So one of the things that we ought to do is allow local elected officials, give them the power to try to deal with gun violence. But in Indiana, they preempted it. So the Indiana legislature is the group that's decided that they and they alone can decide what kind of regulations we can have on gun violence. Of course, the U.S. Congress could do something, too. But U.S. Congress has done very little to deal with gun violence. We really don't have many laws on the books at the national level or at the state level to make it harder for dangerous people to get dangerous weapons.
However, the burden of this oversight will not be felt by the legislature, but instead falls heavily upon the Indianapolis community. The shooting, which occurred at a FedEx facility whose staff of 4,000 is made up of 90% Sikh Americans, has significantly impacted the Sikh community in Indianapolis and across the country. WFHB spoke with Ravleen Ahuja, president of the Sikh Student Association at Indiana University Bloomington, to hear her perspective on the tragic event. Ravleen described her position within the organization and the work the Sikh Student Association does at Indiana University.
I'm president along with Taveen Saran, who is a sophomore. We're both co-presidents and co-founders. We founded the organization in 2019, so like 2 years ago. And, you know, IU has a pretty large Indian population. However, in America and in India, like Sikhs are a minority population. So yeah, you know, we have Indian nationality, but being a Sikh and being from Punjab is like a whole other experience. So we wanted to create, you know, a space for people like us. And also, you know, I think it's a little bit behind the game. You know, a lot of other schools, especially schools in California, or I'm from Ohio, like Ohio State has a Sikh Student Association. A lot of people do. It was time that we created one.
Ravleen expressed the distress felt both personally and with the Sikh community as a whole, saying,
you know, when attacks like this happen on our community, we oftentimes have to spend time educating everyone on who we are. And it kind of takes away from the tragic events that happen because we constantly have to be like, this is who we are. This is what we stand for. And, you know, other major religions don't really have to go through that, which is great for them. But we hope that, you know, people who aren't a part of our group or faith can take time out and learn about us so that we can move forward and things like this don't happen again.
This specific shooting has been an especially troubling event for the Sikh community, as the shooter's past employment at the same FedEx facility and his history visiting white supremacist sites online raises questions of his motive.
The shooter was a previous employee of the FedEx location, so, and he obviously knows that it's a primarily Sikh location to be, and he knew what time he was going. He knew it was like a very populated time, and he also like aimed specifically at Sikh employees and made a concerted effort to avoid non-Sikhs at various points.
With the investigation still underway, the Sikh community is left to mourn this tragic loss. Ravleen shared some information about upcoming memorial services for all of the victims.
Just in the Bloomington community, at least, SSA, this Sunday at 7 p.m. at Sample Gates is having a candlelight vigil. Candles will be provided, masks are required, but we encourage you to come. I think, you know, we're going to commemorate all the victims and it's a really nice way to remember them.
It may be too soon to say if the tragedy at the FedEx facility will serve as a turning point in Indiana state gun legislation, or if it will be just another addition to the growing list of mass shootings in the United States. Paul Helmke says he is hopeful for Indiana's future, that this tragedy may espouse change in the state's gun policies.
I would hope that this FedEx shooting would be a wake-up call for our legislators and for the people in the state to realize how weak our gun laws are. You know, nobody's trying to take everybody's guns away, but we should all agree that we don't want people with dangerous tendencies, dangerous propensities, people who have exhibited this dangerousness to be able to legally get a gun. That puts us all at risk. So hopefully this will be a wake-up call. And what it's going to take, though, are individuals across the state contacting their state legislators, contacting their other local officials to have them lobby our state legislators to say, let's make our laws stronger. Let's focus, instead of focusing just on the gun that the dangerous person has, let's focus on keeping that dangerous person from being able to get other guns. Instead of assuming that everyone should be able to get any gun and take it anywhere at any time, let's have true background check systems. Let's have a waiting period. Let's check somebody out. It's easier to get it's easier to get a gun than it is to get a job at a fast food restaurant. You know, we don't ask for reference checks or anything else. We just assume that anyone should have a gun, and that's what puts us all at risk.
WFHB would like to take a moment and honor the names of the victims of this tragic event, as read by President of the Sikh Student Association, Ravlin Ahuja.
Amarjeet Sekhon, who is 48. We have Jasvinder Kaur, who is 50. Amarjeet Kaur Johal, who is 66. And she actually went to go pick up her check and died with her check in her hand, which is so tragic. Jasvinder Singh, who is 68. Samaria Blackwell, who was 19 years old. Carly Smith, who was also 19. Matthew R. Alexander, who was 32. John Steve Weisart, who was 74.
For WFHB News, I'm Max Campbell.
Up next, today marks the start of our spring fun drive here at WFHB. News department staff Cade Young and Benedict Jones talk about why independent local news is so important, and they offer reasons why you should support your community radio station, WFHB.
Hi, this is WFHB News Director Cade Young.
And I'm Assistant News Director Jake Jacobson.
We wanted to talk with you, the WFHB local news listeners, about why independent local news is so important now more than ever.
The WFHB local news brings you a half hour's worth of local, independently sourced news 4 nights a week on your community radio station.
Our dedicated, passionate volunteers seek truth and report it. Our program contains information from the ground up, with volunteers reaching out to local people to find out more about the issues that impact you.
Right now, there are many communities who have little to no local news coverage, without access to reliable sources of local news and information.
Meanwhile, here at WFHB, we continue to report on local government meetings and issues that impact our community. In this era where corporate media dominates local news just about everywhere, WFHB has managed to stay local and independent without any corporate influence. And we thank you, the listener, for helping us keep it that way.
Today marks the start of our spring fun drive here at WFHB. In order to keep the lights on and the FM signal broadcasting to South Central Indiana's airwaves, we need your financial support.
Please donate online right now at wfhb.org and click the red donate button. Please consider becoming a sustaining member by selecting a recurring payment in our secure pay portal. If you're already a sustaining member, consider increasing your monthly amount by setting up a new recurring payment.
Last but not least, our Spring Fun Drive Day sponsor today is the Ryder Film Series. For more than a quarter century, the Ryder Film Series has presented foreign language, independent, and classic American films at locations around Bloomington. The Ryder Film Series is currently hosting the Oscars Short Film Festival. Information about this week's screenings can be found online at theryder.com. That's theryder.com.
Thank you for listening to the WFHB local news.
And thank you for supporting your community radio station, WFHB.
You've been listening to the WFHB local news. Today's headlines were written by Jake Jacobson in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Max Campbell.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Lucinda Larnach.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast online at WFHB.org.
The WFHB local news is also available as a podcast. Just search all our call letters, WFHB, wherever you find your podcasts. Subscribe and never miss another local news program.
Stay tuned for Big Talk with Michael Glad. Coming up next on WFHB Community Radio.
You've been listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@WFHB.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,